Good morning to each one present this morning. I trust that our hearts have already been blessed and we've been challenged at the things we've already heard and the singing of the songs, reading of the Word. It's been good to fellowship together in this way. I wasn't aware of some of the visitors that were here, but I decided to apply the golden rule and continue on with the service as planned. I might just say one thing here. I don't know how many of you are aware of this. A lot of you would have known Orrin Eveleth. He passed away yesterday. He would be Clayton's older brother and been around this community for a number of years. So I thought that might be of interest to you. Also, I suppose most of you know that Elsie and I were gone for about 10 days, just got home last evening. We had a good time in Arkansas reconnecting with her family there. So this morning I have a message in mind I'd like to share. Maybe just as a prelude before we get into that, I might just ask, if you were asked where in the Bible do we find that the mercy and the grace and the long-suffering of God bring salvation to mankind, you'd likely say, well, it's the account of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. And it's true. And yet I'm impressed at how repeatedly in the Old Testament God's redemptive work with mankind is so often portrayed. There's a number of accounts in the Old Testament that shows the grace and the mercy of God, that God is more than just the God of judgment, and that He works in a long-suffering way with mankind. And there's a number of accounts that prefigure the gracious love of God in sending His Son to die for us. And I just thought of a few that I might just mention. You know, I think of Joseph. How he was a figure of Christ. And how he was mistreated by his brethren. And yet through him, there was salvation. That there were many there that not only in the land of Egypt, but surrounding areas, there were multitudes of people that were saved from starvation because of the salvation that he brought. I think of the account of Abraham on Mount Moriah there with his son Isaac, and Leland already mentioned that this morning. But that prefigures the sacrifice of God's only Son. I think of Rahab. It's an interesting story. A heathen woman who was saved. She was actually a believer. She believed the things that she had heard about God and His people. And she was saved from destruction. I think of Naaman. He was a leper. And he was a captain of the Syrian army. And through his faith, his disease was taken care of. And so it just shows to me that down through time, God, in His mercy, has relieved people, has saved people, has called them to Himself. So this morning we'd like to look at another Old Testament character. And this is one that if we would follow or understand the political policies of the day, he was or basically should have been a dead man. He could not expect to continue to live because his grandfather, who was king, and his father, who was heir to the throne, were killed in battle and their kingdom was given to another. So the story we'd like to look at this morning is the story of Mephibosheth. And I'm sure you are acquainted with that. But we'd like to draw some lessons from that this morning. I've been challenged and encouraged and has made me appreciate again what God does for us. This poor man, Mephibosheth, he was the son of the king. But he was a poor, miserable man. And he had nothing of which he could offer the present king. He had physical conditions that made it almost impossible for him to be useful. And he was an unworthy person. He was a grandson of a great king. But he was now relegated to obscurity. And there was nothing to suggest royalty on his part. He was a cripple. And he was totally dependent upon the help of others. And he was really just an outcast. And I think that this story can be looked at as a type of my and your utter uselessness or unworthiness to be called into the royal court of the King of Kings, of Jesus Christ. Thinking a little bit of the king at that time, which was David, prior to his becoming king, he was unmercifully hunted by his enemies, and especially King Saul. And as you read through the Psalms, you'll see again and again where it seems that David complains to the Lord about his enemies and how they have sought him and how they've tried to take his life and how he's almost like his life is on a shoestring. But even in his time of distress, it seemed that many in Israel knew that David was destined to be the next king. And so after Saul and his sons were killed in battle there on Gilboa with the Philistines, the kingdom then was given to David. First he reigned in Hebron for about 7.5 years, and then all Israel made him king, and he chose Jerusalem as his royal city. You know, what a man is and does as an underdog can be totally different than what he is if he's given just a little bit of power. And we know that this was a concern of Joseph's brothers. I already mentioned Joseph and, you know, how he was ruler over all of Egypt. And so his brothers were concerned about how he was going to treat them because they had so mistreated him. They had wronged him. But he assured them that no, you know, he accepted them and he had forgiven them. But then they were afraid again after Jacob, their father, died. What's Joseph going to do with this? And I can only imagine how the kingdom of Israel must have wondered and perhaps even trembled when they saw this underdog, David, come into power. What is he now going to do? How is he going to rectify all that has been done wrong to him? They knew him as a mighty warrior, and he was known as one to destroy the enemies of God. And so, what will he do now? Will he try to cut off and to destroy and to take the life of those who had been out to get him in earlier years? In fact, that was the usual act of a king when he came into power, when there was a change of dynasties, was to destroy any living heir, lest that heir might try again to take the throne. And so if there would have been anyone left in Saul's descendants, that they would be gotten out of the way. All right, I think I'm going to take the time. It's going to take just a little bit of time, but I'd like to read this story just in bits and pieces here. In 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel that leads up to what we want to talk about here. So I'm going to start, first of all, in 1 Samuel 18. And we see a very unique situation. We have the heir to the throne of Jonathan meeting the heir to the throne because he had been anointed by God's prophet. And yet it says that their souls were knit together, and Jonathan and David made a covenant. But you know, these two men should have been enemies, rightfully, I guess you'd say, because they were both heirs to the throne. Who's going to get the upper hand here? All right, first of all, I'm going to read the first four verses out of 1 Samuel 18. And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. And so here we find the son of the king. He took off his royal apparel and he said, David, this is yours. I give it to you. And they made a covenant between themselves that they would honor each other from there on. Now let's go to chapter 20 and let's look a little bit more at this covenant. I'd like to read verses 11 to 17. And Jonathan said unto David, come and let us go out into the field. And they went out, both of them, into the field. And Jonathan said unto David, O Lord God of Israel, when I have sounded my father about tomorrow any time, or the third day, and behold, if there be good toward David, and then I send not unto thee and show it thee, the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do thee evil, then I will show it thee and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace, and the Lord be with thee as he hath been with my father. And thou shalt not only, while yet I live, show me the kindness of the Lord, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies. And Jonathan caused David to swear again, because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. It seems here, well, there's several things here. Jonathan knew that his father Saul was bent on destroying David. He also knew that the kingdom was going to be given to David. And he told David, he says, let's make a covenant between us that you will not destroy my seed after me, after I am gone. And so he caused David to swear again. All right, let's go to chapter 24. And this was, a little bit of a new thought to me in studying this. That actually, while Saul was pursuing David and wanting to destroy him, and you know that story, how that Saul went into a cave and David and his men were in there, and how David cut off part of his skirt and Saul went out, not knowing that David had been there, David could have killed him. And then David called out after Saul and showed him what he had done. And then I want to read what Saul had to say. But here, Saul asks of David not to cut off his descendants. All right? Samuel 24, verse 16. And it came to pass, when David had made the end of speaking these words unto Saul, that Saul said, is this thy voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded thee evil. And thou hast showed this day how that thou hast dealt well with me, for as much as when the Lord hath delivered me into thine hand, thou killest me not. For if a man find his enemy, will he let him go well away? Wherefore the Lord reward thee good for that which thou hast done unto me this day. And notice this, and now, behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thine hand. Saul knew this. David is going to become king. Swear now, therefore, unto me by the Lord, that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and that thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house. And David sware unto Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men got them up under the hold. And so Saul said, David, I know you're going to be king. Will you swear to me that you will not do like other kings and just destroy all the royal seed? David said, I will not. I'll make a covenant with you. All right, let's go to 2 Samuel 4:4. And this is at the time that Saul and Jonathan were killed by the Philistines. And it's very possible that David did not even know of Saul's little son Mephibosheth. He was only 5 years old. Saul had been out in the wilderness, in the hills, and had been away from the people of God there, or from Saul at least, the royal city and so on. Verse 4, and Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son that was lame of his feet. He was 5 years old when the tidings came of Saul and Jonathan out of Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it came to pass as she made haste to flee that he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Then I'd like to read the 9th chapter. I think I'll read that entire chapter. But before that, let's get just a little bit of what took place here in the meantime. We see how that David was securing his kingdom. He had not forgotten his covenant with Jonathan, or with Saul. Well, I shouldn't say covenant with Saul, but his promise to Saul. And he had not plan to withhold anything from Jonathan's posterity, but he probably didn't really know if there was anybody that was left of Saul's descendants. But first of all, he needed to secure his kingdom. And he fought with his enemies on every side, the Philistines and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the different ones, and he secured his kingdom. He was consolidating it. And then he brought the ark to Jerusalem. And finally there was peace that prevailed, and then he felt that he could endeavor to fulfill his covenant with Jonathan. He was ready to do that, and he made inquiry. I don't know for sure how much time elapsed, and I'm not necessarily going to go into this, but we'll find here in chapter 9 that Mephibosheth had a son. And so, you know, probably at least 15 to 20 years had transpired from the time of Mephibosheth, or from the time of Jonathan's death until David fulfilled this. That's not real important, I guess, but it's kind of interesting. All right, let's read chapter 9 of 2 Samuel, and this is pretty much the basis of the rest of what I'd like to share here this morning. And David said, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they called him unto David, the king said unto him, "Art thou Ziba?" And he said, "Thy servant is he." And the king said, "Is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I may show kindness of God unto him?" And Ziba said unto the king, "Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet." And the king said unto him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said unto the king, "Behold, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Melial, in Lodibar." Then King David sent and fetched him out of the house of Micah, the son of Amiel, from Lodibar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was coming to David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold thy servant." And David said unto him, "Fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually." And he bowed himself and said, "What is thy servant that thou shouldest look upon such a dead dog as I am?" Then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, "I have given unto thy master's son all that pertain to Saul and to all his house. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants shall till the land for him, and thou shalt bring in the fruits that thy master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, thy master's son, shall eat bread always at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then said Ziba unto the king, "According to all that my lord the king hath commanded his servants, so shall thy servant do. As for Mephibosheth," said the king, "he shall eat at my table as one of the king's sons." And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all that dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants unto Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he did eat continually at the king's table and was lame on both his feet. And so now we find David ready to fulfill his covenant with his bosom friend, Jonathan. And he says, is there anybody? He makes inquiry. Is there anybody left of the house of Saul? He didn't even really ask whether there's any of Jonathan's house, if we see that. But Ziba told him that there was a son of Jonathan by the name of Mephibosheth who was living at Lodibar. Now there's some that think that this may have been the home area of Jonathan's wife and that maybe this nurse took this son and fled there. We don't know. As near as I can find out, this Lodibar was on the east side of Jordan. It would have been some distance from Jerusalem. And actually this place was a place of insignificance. And the name Lodibar means nothingness. And so here was a deposed prince who was living in a land of nothingness that had nothing by which he could be called royalty at all. And so here we have the invitation of a king to a man from a land of nothingness to come and appear before him. And I'm sure that there must have been fear in Mephibosheth's heart. I suppose all these years he wondered when the day would come when King David would find him and would destroy him because he was of the royal seed. And now here he gets a call to come to King David. And I suppose that he would have wondered or would have thought that surely now he's going to be put to death. And you know, it's very likely, very possible that Mephibosheth had no idea of the covenant between his father and David. He was only 5 years old at the time that his father died. And so here comes this cripple into the royal court of King David. And dragging his feet as he comes. And he comes with fear and he comes with dread. What can I take to the king? What kind of an offering? What kind of a peace? What can I do to make amends? There is nothing. I have no gift to bring. I have no merit of my own. I don't even have physical strength. And he falls before King David and he did him reverence. David says, Mephibosheth. It was a kindly gesture on David's part. He didn't tell him, because you are the son of that king who hunted me down in the wilderness, I am now going to destroy you. He says, fear not. And he tells this poor lame man that because of his father, he wants to show the kindness of God to him. And he also tells him that the land that had been in the family of Saul was going to be restored to him. But not only that, it's not just that David says, you know, it's good to see you. I'm glad to see you're doing as good as you are. No. He says, you're going to sit at my table the rest of your life. You're going to become one of mine. You're going to be like a son of mine. And Mephibosheth responded, what is thy servant that thou shouldest look upon such a dead dog as I am? And you know, to me this morning, this is such a beautiful type of how God calls His children today out of obscurity and gives them a place in the heavenly kingdom. He calls the lowly and the rejected out of a place of nothingness and gives them the place at the banquet feast. I'd like to take just a few moments and think of this maybe from four different points. First of all, born a prince. Secondly, he was lost. And third, he was sought. Fourth, he was found. Fifth, we find him self-abased. Sixth, comforted. And seven, exalted. And as I go through this very briefly, I hope we can get the picture how this is what God does for you. It's what he has done for me. Now, this part of being born a prince, were any of us born a prince? Well, I think from this angle, we know that Mephibosheth was born into a royal family. And in the eyes of Israel at that time, he had a favored position. And likely the throne would become his in years to come. But because of the sins of his grandfather, Saul, the family line was deposed from kingship. And I think the application we can make is that each one of us have been born. We were created in the likeness of the King of Kings. Man was created to be like God, to be in the likeness of God, I should say. But because of the sin of our father Adam, the human race has been deposed from that which was originally planned. And we have been consigned to Lodibar. We are as nothing, and we have nothing to bring to the king. And so secondly, we find then that there is a condition of being lost. I think that probably to Israel, this former prince was lost. I really wonder how many people knew that there was a son of Jonathan living at Lodibar. Not only was he out of sight, but he was a cripple. And he could do little to get around. Here was the grandson of the king, who was living in obscurity, and he was lost. We know that we too have been lost. We come from a fallen race. We come from a sinful background. There's nothing good about us, nothing that we can bring to the king. And it would seem that no one cares. But there's one that does care. King David sought for a descendant of Saul. David wondered, is there anyone of Saul's family still living? And so he called Ziba and he inquired. I believe David had a yearning compassion. He said, is there yet any of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God unto him? That's a noble statement there. Who initiated this? It wasn't Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth did not come to the court of David groveling and saying, is there any way that I could just get a crust of bread from your table? Is there any way that you could give me any recognition at all? After all, I was born a prince, and here I am, I'm a pauper. But when it came time to seek, it was the king who did the seeking. The initiation was by David. And I think that's such a beautiful picture. That we had nothing to do with God seeking to save the lost. Outside of him, we would not have known that there might even be anything better. And so it's on the part of God to search for poor, lost, dying souls. When there was a lost sheep, who sought for it? Did the sheep try to come back? That shepherd went out in the hills and found that lost sheep. And so Jesus too has a yearning for the lost. As he ministered to the people there, he saw the sheep. He saw them as sheep without a shepherd. He shed tears over Jerusalem. His life and his suffering and his death came from a heart of yearning compassion, seeking for that which was lost. Luke 19:10 says, for the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. I'd like to read several verses from Ezekiel 34. And this here is the heart of God, even back in the time of the prophets. He saw that there were people who were scattered as sheep. They were being downtrodden. They weren't being fed right. They weren't being taken care of, and the shepherds of Israel were not taking care of them as they ought. And then he says this in Ezekiel 34, verses 11 to 16, "For thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will both search my sheep and seek them out." God was going to search for them. "As a shepherd seeketh out his flock in the day that he is among his sheep that are scattered, so will I seek out my sheep and will deliver them out of all places where they have been scattered in the cloudy and dark day. And I will bring them out from the people and gather them from the countries, will bring them to their own land and feed them upon the mountains of Israel by the rivers and in all the inhabited places of the country. I will feed them at a good pasture, and upon the high mountains of Israel shall their fold be. There shall they lie in a good fold and in a fat pasture. And in a fat pasture shall they feed upon the mountains of Israel. I will feed my flock, and I will cause them to lie down. I will seek that which was lost, and bring again that which was driven away, and will bind up that which is broken, and will strengthen that which was sick. But I will destroy the fat and the strong, and I will feed them with judgment." And so we find a picture of the true shepherd of Israel. He said, "I'm going to go out, and I'm going to find my sheep. And I'm going to bring them back. And I'm going to feed them. I'm going to bring them to a place of good feed." All right, number four then, he was found. David was uncertain if there were any of Saul's descendants still living, but after searching, he found. He found this son. He found the son of Jonathan. He found a man that was broken in body. He found a man that was broken in spirit. He found a man that was living in fear. And on this man, he could pour out his desire to show grace and to show kindness to his former friend, Jonathan. And I believe this morning that when God seeks for us, He will find us. And it depends how we respond to Him. You know, Mephibosheth could have said, I don't want to go. I'm not going to go to the king's court. But the lost sheep was found. David did not forget his covenant. Even so, God did not forget the covenant that He had made with His people. It was interesting for me to read there in Luke 1, I believe it was the words of Zechariah. After his son John was born, he said, "To perform the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember His holy covenant, the oath which He swore to our father Abraham." So John the Baptist was sent. He was a forerunner of the Messiah, so that the mercy that had been promised to the fathers and this holy covenant, this oath that He had made with Abraham could be fulfilled. And so God did not fulfill that just a year or so after He promised it, but there was a time, there was a fullness of time that had to take place, and so it was with David and Mephibosheth. Number five, we find then that Mephibosheth was self-abased. He had nothing in which to glory. Yes, he had been a prince in Israel, but now he was in obscurity. And he looked at himself as coming from nothingness, with nothing to offer the king. And he bowed himself and said, "What is thy servant that thou shouldest look upon such a dead dog as I am?" He saw himself as nothing but a dead dog, which dogs were really looked down upon in in Israel there. He was low down. He felt himself low down. He felt himself unworthy. He trembled the presence of the king and was overcome with a sense of his own unworthiness. And as I think about our situation before God, before Jesus Christ, do we have anything to offer to God? We are unworthy. We have nothing. We are as paupers. Spiritual paupers in the sight of God. Then we find that he was comforted. The king comforted Mephibosheth. And David said unto him, "Fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually." David didn't cast him out of his sight because of his lowly position, because he was a cripple, because he couldn't walk, because he couldn't do anything. What could Mephibosheth contribute to the court of the king? Really nothing. But David did not cast him out. He comforted him. You know, so it is with Jesus. He reaches out in tenderness and compassion to me, to you, even though we have nothing to contribute to Him. And He calls us each by name. Mephibosheth, Jason, whoever you might be. He sought us out and He comes to bring comfort. Reminds me of Jesus talking to the woman taken in adultery. You know, He didn't condemn her. But rather He spoke comforting to her. He says, did no one condemn you? She said, none. He said, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. And so when Jesus comes to restore us to sonship, to children of the King, He doesn't point out our shortcomings, but He supplies all the needs and the wants of His subjects. And then, last, we find then that He was exalted. Here was one that was as good as dead. Here was one that had lived in fear all of his life. And now he is brought to the King. And what does the King do? The King puts him in a position of being a son and continually eating at his table. He was raised from social degradation and obscurity to a position of great distinction. The King would have nothing less but that he should be a constant guest at his table. What a marvelous change it must have been to this outcast. And you know, so it is with us. Jesus, in His love and mercy, seeks us out and raises us up to be joint heirs with Him, that we are actually heirs of the kingdom of God in which Jesus is an heir. We now become the sons of God, but as many as received Him, to them gave He power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on His name. And so everyone, we all deserve death. We are all lame spiritually. We are dead dogs, dead in trespasses and sins. But I am a recipient of God's grace and mercy. Romans 5:8, but God commendeth His love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God does not give us what we deserve. Just as David gave Mephibosheth life in abundance, so Jesus does the same to us. In John 10:10, He says, I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. Maybe to put just a little bit of a word picture to this scene, let's see if we can picture the royal family getting ready to sit down for a meal. I don't know who their cooks were, but they say that all is ready. Everybody can come. And so King David, in his royal robes, he comes. And there's beautiful surroundings. And I don't know what it was. There was probably gleaming brass. Maybe there was even gold and silver in this lovely dining room. And there's a place that is set for each one of the family. And over here is handsome Absalom. Beautiful, shining black hair. A young man of strength and beauty. And over here is his lovely daughter Tamar, and she takes her place with her robes of virginity about her. And over here and here and here are the other sons. David had a lot of sons, but there was a place for each one. But David comes in and he looks around. And there's one place where one of the family is missing. And then he hears, coming down the hall, scrape, thump, scrape, thump. And here comes the one that's missing. The one that is lamed. And this lame one comes to the royal table, puts his feet under the table. The tablecloth covers it all. And you cannot even see that there is any deformity in his life. Can you with me, can you hear that in your mind's eye? Scrape, thump, scrape, thump, scrapes them. That is the noise of me. That is me coming to the royal table. I'd like to read yet several first part of Ephesians 2. Ephesians 2, verses 1 to 9. And you hath he quickened who were dead in trespasses and sins, where in time past ye walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience, among whom also we all had our conversation in times past in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others. But God, who is rich in mercy, for his great love wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace ye are saved, and hath raised us up together, and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. For by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. It says here that we were dead in trespasses and sins. We were dead, just like Mephibosheth. But God, who is rich in mercy, he saved us. And he raised us up together, made us sit together in heavenly places. By grace are we saved through faith. So I trust that we can appreciate this type of Jesus and what he has done to save us from sin. Let's have a closing thought.